Today is Wednesday, March 17th, and you are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, U.S. lawmakers turn attention to migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border.
We did not expel them as the Trump administration did. We took in those children and placed them in the custody of Health and Human Services.
Also, human rights officials express alarm at the growing death toll in Myanmar.
At least 37 journalists have been arrested, of whom 19 remain in arbitrary detention.
Plus, aid comes to some African civic organizations facing virtual challenges because of COVID. These stories and more are next. U.S. lawmakers are struggling to find solutions to growing numbers of unaccompanied migrant minors arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reports on the stalemate.
At least 40 children detained in these tents at the U.S.-Mexico border. Just some of the estimated 4,200 unaccompanied minors who have overwhelmed U.S. authorities in recent weeks, putting the Biden administration on the defensive. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas.
We did not expel them as the Trump administration did. We took in those children and placed them in the care and custody of Health and Human Services until we can put them in the custody of a parent.
The recent surge at the border could be due in part to a perception that under the new Biden administration, America is now more welcoming to asylum seekers. The Federal Emergency Management Agency is now stepping in to help. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
This is one of the steps that the president felt would help not become a final solution, but help expedite processing, help ensure that people who are coming across the border are have access to health and medical care. Clearly, the numbers are enormous. This is a big challenge.
Republicans visiting the border say Biden has made the problem worse, some claiming his policies are allowing suspected terrorists to cross over into the United States. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy.
The health of this nation, the safety and security of Americans and our border is the job of the president.
A longer-term solution to the long-running debate over immigration will be even harder to find. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. President Joe Biden is touring the country to pitch his $1.9 trillion COVID relief package as he seeks to help Americans return to normalcy, both in life and in how they view the presidency. White House correspondent Patsy Widas-Kuwara looks at how Biden's crisis communication style compares to his predecessors.
As the nation struggles to return to normalcy, President Joe Biden is on a multi-city tour promoting the $1.9 trillion relief package he signed last week, with stimulus checks already delivered to some Americans. Focused on the coronavirus during his first 2 months in office, Biden has sought to return the presidency to its more traditional role after four unorthodox and often tumultuous years under Donald Trump.
We need to remember the government isn't some foreign force in a distant capital. No, it's us, all of us, we the people.
Marking a year of the pandemic last week, Biden offered empathy as Americans mourn the loss of 530,000 lives and hope as his administration closes in on 100 million vaccine shots in just 60 days.
And the people who knocked these buildings down will hear all of us soon.
Previous presidents have done the same. George W. Bush's speech after the 9/11 terrorist attacks and Barack Obama's tearful address after a school massacre both captured the emotions of the country. Jeff Bennett teaches political communications at Vanderbilt University.
These kinds of rituals are meant to do is give a sense of meaning to people about why these things happened, what we make of them as a country, and how we might move forward together.
65% of Americans approve of Biden's handling of the pandemic, in part because, unlike his predecessor, he does not downplay the crisis.
The virus will not have a chance against us. No nation is more prepared or more resilient than the United States.
But Biden faces steep challenges. No congressional Republican supported his stimulus package.
This is a classic example of big government Democratic overreach in the name of COVID relief.
While Biden says he wants to bring the country together, only 48% of Americans believe that he can.
That's VOA's White House correspondent Patsy Widas-Kuwara. Eight people are dead after shooting at three separate massage parlors in and around the Atlanta area Tuesday evening. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
Police say 21-year-old Robert Aaron Long is in custody after he was captured on the highway. The shootings began around 5 p.m. at Young's Asian Massage Parlor in Acworth, then continued within the hour in Atlanta at Gold Spa and across the street at Aromatherapy Spa. South Korea's foreign ministry says at least four of the victims are women of Korean descent. Captain Jay Baker with the Cherokee County Sheriff's Office says they're not ruling anything out in terms of motive. The killings come amid a wave of attacks against Asian Americans that coincide with the spread of the coronavirus.
Nothing's going to be ruled out. We're conducting a homicide, a multiple homicide investigation. So wherever the evidence leads us, that's where the investigators will go.
That audio, courtesy of WGCL. I'm Julie Walker.
North Korea has issued new threats against the U.S. and South Korea. Kim Yong-jong, the powerful sister of ruler Kim Jong-un, said in an official media statement the two allies could face consequences for conducting annual joint military exercises. Her remarks come as top American foreign policy and defense officials hold talks with partners this week in Northeast Asia. Jason Struther reports from Seoul.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin wrapped up security talks Tuesday in Tokyo. They met with Japan's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Toshimitsu Motegi, and Defense Minister Nobuo Kishi. During a press event, Secretary Blinken said Washington has tried reaching out to Pyongyang but has received no response.
As you know, the North Korea policy is under review. We're looking at whether various additional pressure measures could be effective, whether there are diplomatic paths that make sense. All of that is under review, and it's under review in close consultation with our allies and partners.
The U.S. officials will travel Wednesday to Seoul, where North Korea's nuclear weapons program is expected to be high on the agenda. Blinken and Austin are also trying to reaffirm a counterbalance to China's influence in the region. The defense secretary says Beijing's increased aggression in disputed waters is a threat to both the U.S. and Japan.
I know Japan shares our concerns with China's destabilizing actions. And as I have said before, China is a pacing challenge for the Department of Defense. And we know that competing in today's shifting global dynamics can only be done through the spirit of teamwork and cooperation, which are the hallmarks of our alliance with Japan.
Foreign Minister Motegi says Tokyo's position on China is the same as Washington's. We agree to oppose China's unilateral bid to change the status quo in the East China Sea and the South China Sea, Motegi said. A recent White House strategy paper named China as the biggest threat to America's interests. Robert Dujaric, co-director of the Institute for Contemporary Asian Studies at Temple University's Tokyo campus, tells VOA that strengthening partnerships in the Pacific is one way to put pressure on China.
Beijing would prefer the relationship between the U.S., Japan, and South Korea to be bad because they don't want their adversaries to work closely together, but there's not much they can do.
But Washington is leaving the door open for dialogue with Beijing. Following talks in South Korea, Secretary Blinken will depart for Anchorage, Alaska, to meet with senior Chinese foreign policy officials. Jason Struther for VOA News, Seoul.
Also on Tuesday, the head of the U.S. military's Northern Command, Air Force General Glenn Van Herk, said the Biden administration will, quote, always maintain our ability to defend our homeland, unquote. This as North Korea might begin testing an improved design for its intercontinental ballistic missile, a move that could increase tensions between Pyongyang and Washington. The warning by Van Herk appeared based on North Korea's October unveiling at a parade of what would be its largest ICBM yet, and not specific intelligence about an imminent launch.
Yeah, so in the public parade we saw on the 10th of October, we saw additional capabilities and additional missile. Now they're up to three missiles that we assess could strike our homeland. I'll go back to what I told Lucas. We always maintain the ability to defend our homeland and obviously the right to defend the homelands. We're postured each and every day through ground-based interceptors, which create deterrence by denial. I'll go back to the foundation of our defense and homeland defense is our nuclear triad and our nuclear deterrence capabilities. take the nuclear deterrence capabilities, combine that with our ground-based interceptors and ballistic missile capabilities, and I think we have a good posture for deterrence.
China says it has protested to the United States and Japan over a joint statement it says, quote, maliciously attacked, unquote, its foreign policy and interfered in China's internal affairs. A foreign ministry spokesman said China was, quote, strongly dissatisfied and resolutely opposed, unquote, to Tuesday's statement from Japan and China during a meeting of the top diplomats and defense officials. The comments Wednesday came a day before U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken is due to meet with Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi and a top foreign policy advisor in Alaska. Protesters against the military takeover in Myanmar are not relenting, even as the deadly crackdown on peaceful demonstrations takes an increasing toll. Violence has returned after demonstrators protesting last month's military coup held small, peaceful marches before dawn and avoided confrontations with security forces who have shot and killed scores of their countrymen in recent days. In the largest city of Yangon, where casualties have been the highest, police used rubber bullets against crowds in several neighborhoods. One man was reportedly to have been shot and killed. Another death was reported in the city of Kowloon in the northwestern Saigang region. Human rights officials are expressing alarm at the soaring death toll in Myanmar as the military junta's security forces intensify their brutal crackdown on protesters. Lisa Schnein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The past week has been particularly deadly. The UN Human Rights Office says 11 people were killed on Monday and 57 over the weekend by security forces that used live ammunition against peaceful protesters. Since February 1st, when Myanmar's military toppled the democratically elected government of Aung San Suu Kyi, the UN agency confirms at least 149 people have been killed, though it says it believes the number of deaths to be much higher. UN Human Rights spokeswoman Ravina Shantasani says her agency continues to receive distressing reports of people being arbitrarily arrested, forcibly disappeared, and brutally beaten and tortured while in detention. By last count, she says, more than 2,084 people remain arbitrarily detained.
At least 37 journalists have been arrested, of whom 19 remain in arbitrary detention. At least 5 deaths in custody have occurred in recent weeks, and at least 2 victims' bodies have shown signs of severe physical abuse, indicating that they were tortured.
A day after Sunday's deadly crackdown on protesters, Myanmar's military authorities declared martial law in a number of townships in and around Yangon and Mandalay. That means military law now will apply to civilians, subjecting offenders to military tribunals that give them no right of appeal. Many countries and human rights activists have been calling for economic sanctions and an arms embargo on Myanmar's military coup leaders. Shamdasani dismisses Myanmar's claims that under international law, countries have no right to interfere in its internal affairs. She says that is an argument often raised by countries where serious human rights situations are occurring.
Where the state fails to protect the human rights, or where the state is carrying out human rights violations against its own people, it is the duty of the international community to do something about it, to take measures to bring the violence to an end, to take measures to ensure accountability. You cannot argue non-interference when you are shooting your own people.
Human rights officials are calling on the military to stop killing and detaining protesters. UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet is appealing to all those with influence to take measures to bring an end to the state violence against the Myanmar people. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
While the COVID-19 pandemic continues to affect most on the planet, there has been a growing effort to distribute pandemic resources and especially vaccines in a fair way among all the peoples of the world, whether rich or poor. To learn more about the efforts, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Thomas Boyke, Senior Fellow for Global Health, Economics and Development at the Council on Foreign Relations and Coordinator of its Independent Task Force on Preparing for the Next Pandemic.
Domestically, in the United States, that a big focus of the incoming Biden administration has been around equity in terms of how we address the pandemic. That's a response to what we saw in the early months, where you saw terribly inequitable outcomes for Black and Latino populations and Native American populations.
What's another example that signifies that the shift toward equity and inclusion is coming into its own?
A small example, but it gives you some indication. I work for the Council on Foreign Relations. It's a 100-year-old institution, normally very concerned just on foreign affairs and foreign policy. But when we did our task force on pandemic preparedness, it was a lot around equity, both domestically and globally. And that is not normally the kind of thing that ends up in a Council on Foreign Relations report. So thinking about these social issues and what we can do for disadvantaged populations, I think is a greater concern.
I know a lot of the biggest action toward equity in the world is through COVAX. Would you tell us what that is in a nutshell?
So COVAX is part of a larger initiative organized by the World Health Organization to accelerate therapeutics, so medicines, diagnostics, and vaccines to the countries and people that would need it in this crisis. People need to remember this was a novel virus, meaning it's brand new. So there were no effective treatments to get it, not medicines, not vaccines, not diagnostics. All of that had to be developed in response to this virus emerging. What this program was meant to do was try to spur along that development and then rapidly try to accelerate its distribution globally. COVAX, the piece that's dedicated to vaccines, is done by the World Health Organization and a couple of other international NGOs, and it's the one that has gotten the most money and had the most success of those three parts of this larger initiative. And it was built on the fly. There was no COVAX before this crisis began. They have built it in the midst of the crisis over the past year, and they deserve some credit for what it has done so far.
That's Thomas J. Boyke, Senior Fellow for Global Health, Economics and Development at the Council on Foreign Relations and co-director of its independent task force on preparing for the next pandemic. He spoke with my colleague, Adam Phillips. The Ghana-based West Africa Civil Society Institute is offering assistance to organizations in seven African countries facing challenges working remotely because of the coronavirus pandemic. The group recently donated 140 computers, software and hardware to 40 humanitarian groups from Benin, Ghana, Nigeria, Liberia, Cameroon, Sierra Leone, and the Gambia under its Program Assistance Initiative. For more, I spoke with Frank Sambo, Head Monitoring, Evaluation, and Learning.
And it came as a duty for us as a champion within the civil society sector in Africa to stand beside organizations and to provide the support that we could. And so last year we initiated a technology support initiative that consisted of building capacity and providing access to donated software applications to enable organizations face the remote working conditions, because many organizations were not prepared to that, but also to have adequate computer infrastructure to be able to meet their social impact on demand and their obligations within their community.
Why did you decide just seven African countries? What about the others?
This was very limited funding support that we received from a partner. These countries were already target countries where we had some intended interventions with them, and then we had to repurpose the funding to provide technology support as that was not anticipated. I mean, the COVID-19 situation was not anticipated. So it wasn't a selective decision. So we are expecting that and hoping that through this pilot intervention, we may be able to attract further support to scale it up to more countries across the region.
Who are supposed to deploy these computers and to what use?
Technical capacity building and the software application support from Wild Ganzen, as I mentioned, and then the hardware donation fund from TechSoup as part of the COVID relief initiative. And so these are two institutions within the NGO space, the nonprofit space, seeking to alleviate the plight of organizations to enable them to be more effective in their work, and other organizations supporting communities. We have a very strong drive to ensure that organizations at the grassroots level are able to build their resilience and achieve their social impact mandate.
Are youths expected to benefit from this gift?
No, WACSI is not a for-profit institution, and we do not have any hidden agenda in supporting organizations. So it is part of our mandate as a capacity-building organization to ensure that organizations that we are serving within the region or the civil society sector. Our vision as an organization is a West Africa that is peaceful and prosperous, where citizens is at the core, the developmental agenda. So anything that needs to be done with both formal and non-formal civil society organizations is done to ensure that the citizens have a word to say.
That's Frank Sambo, Head Monitoring and Evaluation and Learning of the West African Civil Society Institute. He spoke with me from Accra. This is the Voice of America. A Japanese court has ruled the government's ban on same-sex marriages is unconstitutional, recognizing the rights of same-sex couples for the first time in the only group of seven countries that doesn't acknowledge such legal partnerships. Even though the court dismissed the plaintiff's demand for government compensation, the precedent is a major victory for same-sex couples and could affect similar lawsuits pending around the country. Golf legend Tiger Woods says he's back home in Florida to resume recovering from career-threatening injuries to his right leg. Wood posted a statement on his Twitter that he will be recovering at home and working on getting stronger. He was injured on February 23rd while driving an SUV to a television shoot along winding suburban roads in Los Angeles. The SUV crashed over a median and off the road. He shattered bones in his lower right leg, ankle, and foot. Wood says he's thankful for the outpouring of support. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. The decade-long Syrian conflict has witnessed nearly 500,000 people killed and about 12,000 children dead or injured, the UN Child's Agency, UNICEF, says. The conflict also has resulted in the largest displacement crisis since World War II. In addition to UN agencies, 35 aid organizations have joined to warn of the suffering and increased irreversible damage if growing humanitarian needs in Syria are not met and a political solution is not found to the conflict. Dale Gavlak reports from Amman.
UNICEF Middle East Regional Director Ted Shaiban says continuing violence and economic crisis and COVID-19 are pushing families in Syria to the brink. He told reporters that more than 6 million children inside Syria need assistance, an increase of 20% over last year, as many lack basic services and access to food.
This has been a war that has had a staggering impact on every single child from Syria. The price of the average food basket, what a family eats every week, has skyrocketed in the last year. It has increased over 230%. One in three schools can no longer be used because they were damaged, destroyed, or are being used as shelters for displaced families, or in some cases being used for military purposes.
The International Rescue Committee has joined with Syria Relief and Development, Care International, Save the Children, and a host of other agencies to urge the international community to step up its aid to Syrians across the country and in refugee hosting neighbors in dire need while working toward a political solution to end the crisis. Misty Buswell, IRC Policy and Advocacy Director in the Middle East, told VOA about the concerns of 35 agencies aiding Syrians.
We are seeing more people in need, over 13 million people in need of humanitarian aid now, the highest at any point since the conflict began. But people are in more acute need than ever. Over 6 million people are internally displaced, and many of them had to flee their homes multiple times. Their ability to cope with the challenges has really been stretched as well, and their resilience now after 10 years is reaching a breaking point.
Buswell says the ability to deliver aid across borders must be maintained, while humanitarian access within Syria must be strengthened without having to worry about security issues. We want to see civilians and civilian infrastructure spared, she says, and accountability for violations taking place throughout the conflict. Shaiban drew attention to more than 5,700 Syrian children, some as young as 7 years old, recruited to fight by both the government and opposition forces, with about half serving in frontline combat. UNICEF is calling for their release and an end to using youth as child soldiers. Concerns are also mounting over increased Syrian child labor and child marriages due to the coronavirus outbreak. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Thank you so much for listening and have a great day.